Rabbis have a statement, and I think we should all take it to heart. They say, "Ein beis medrash b'li chiddush." There's no study session without something new. Which means to say that review is not just repeating something or memorizing. Review is another dimension. Understanding what you've learned in another dimension. Review is extremely important. Okay. So hopefully, there's always room for chiddush. I like to learn that. I like to leave a door open so that you can contribute, you can ask questions, and you could even modify the ideas. Now, the general framework in which I'm presenting this is, I've stated this many, many times, that as we study the Torah, we see that it's not just as it appeared when we were children, a book of stories and so forth, that we really can't relate to or understand in a manner which would be meaningful in terms of our own life. That's the way the great people of the Torah appear to us as children, somehow beyond life, and the activities that they did, we don't analyze in the way we'd analyze something in our contemporary life. But this has to be modified. The whole purpose of the stories in the Torah is to demonstrate how people who were imbued with the true philosophy of Torah and had perfected themselves to the highest degree, how they dealt with the problems that life deals up, the same problems that life is going to deal up to us. And therefore we have to approach it in an entirely different way. And to do that, of course, is not so simple, because it's not being written like an ordinary history book. So you have to know how to use the commentaries, the Mefarshim. And they too didn't write in that open a way, but hints and allusions, and there's a whole methodology of uncovering the deeper ideas of Torah. And that's what I try to get across in the various Chumash Yerim and all the Yerim. I'm trying to show you not just an idea, but a methodology. Now, in doing so, you have to change the orientation. You have to change the manner in which you actually read the Torah is extremely important. We're affected by the way we do things in other areas. You know, you're taught to read a book, a history book, a newspaper, whatever the case may be. You read that one way, and then you read the Torah the same way. It can't be. You can't read the Torah like a novel or like even a scientific book. The Torah has to be read very, very carefully. Like I say, you have to read it in slow motion. And when you do so, and you slow it down, you'll notice that it's not so simple. You'll notice suddenly you'll discover questions. Because without questions, you can't go anywhere. You have to discover the problems. And the problems are there. And once you notice them, they become extremely blatant. And you wonder, how could you have read this all along and not notice this? And I find this happening all the time. That's why when I was in New Hampshire for a couple of days, and had a chance to relax, and I was reading some sukkim, and it's pertaining to something that I've read so many times. All of a sudden, it just did not make any sense to me. And I had a question. And that was great, because now I had to start searching for an answer. Without the question, without that problem, I wouldn't have come up with the answer. And maybe I won't come up with the answer. But the first thing is, you should be happy when you find the question. Now, I'd like to illustrate that in a specific area. We've done the Yosef and the brother story in a general sense. But I found recently, I was doing it together with some students, we were doing it just going through the psukim, you know, studying it in slow motion, so to speak. And we saw that there was much, much more there than we had imagined at first, and we came up with some new ideas. And that's what I really want to do. So let me establish the foundations today. This will be essentially in chapter 42. What we're concerned with, the topic, is the confrontation. The details, the specifics of the confrontation between Yosef and his brothers. And basically, as I see it, there are three phases in that confrontation. That is to say, when the brothers go to Egypt to purchase food. I'm not talking about the original situation. That's a different. We're not getting into that right now. We're going to begin at the point where the brothers return to Egypt because of the famine. They need food. Egypt was the only country that had food. And you know the story, the basics. They are confronted by Yosef, who is at the border supervising the situation, which makes sense because Egypt was extremely vulnerable to infiltration. They're the only ones that had food. So he had to be there to make sure that everything was done properly, and also the distribution, the sales, and so forth. This is mega, you know, big business was going on. So Yosef is there. Yosef, of course, according to Chazal, knew that the brothers would have to come down at a certain point. So Yosef recognized his brothers because they had their mature appearance when he was sold, but he was a youth. He was 17. His appearance was completely different. They didn't recognize him, and you know, he accuses them of being spies. And then he locks them up, and then he lets them out, so he holds one behind, and then he tells them that they can go, and they can bring food back home. But of course he sets up a condition, and the condition was that they could not return. He engineers it very beautifully, and because he accuses them of being spies, and we went through the Mefarshim. He based himself on certain things that they had done. They had acted in a strange kind of a way, according to him, because they came in through 10 different gates, as Rashi points out, and then they reunited. So he said, that's very strange activity. Normal people wouldn't do a thing like that. They had done it because they were searching for Yosef. But anyways, their claim was that they're all members of one family. And they had to give him the truth. They had to volunteer that there's one brother missing, and there's one brother that's at home. So he seized upon that, and he said, okay, in order to prove to me that you're honest people, that you're not spies, you're going to leave one brother behind, and I'll interrogate him, I'll find out all I need to know, and then you'll bring back this brother, that you claim you have a brother, which I'm not so convinced about, and if the story is corroborated, then I'll let Shimon go. Okay. Of course, we have to understand what was his whole point in doing all of that. But we've discussed this many times. His objective was, I just want to get this out of the way, his objective was, of course, to bring them back to Tshuva. That was his mission, because it says he remembered the dreams. He had permission to do this because of the prophetic dream that he would be the manhig ruchani, the spiritual leader. And his task was to engineer the situation that would bring about the Tshuva of each of the parties. That is, the brothers would have to overcome their jealousy, their envy of Yosef, who, as you all know by now, who Yosef, as far as the brothers are concerned, is now exists in the form of who? How are they going to overcome their Binyamin? The pasuk makes it very clear that, and that leads us to the repentance, so to speak, of Yaakov. That Yaakov's sin, quote unquote, his error in judgment was that he was overcome by his excessive emotional attachment to Yosef, which caused him to make a serious mistake with regard to his major task at that point in life was to establish the foundations for the 12 tribes, the sons, and here he did something which could have almost destroyed the whole unit of the nation by giving him the Ksonas possum, the garment, the coat. That was a very serious mistake, and it was rooted in a powerful emotion, and Yaakov had to overcome that emotion. That was his tshuva, and the way he would do so, you see that when he lost Yosef, he did not overcome the emotion. He didn't deal with the emotion, did not work it through, because he simply displaced it. He found a substitute, which was Binyamin. Well, this is very clear, and you're all familiar with this. Therefore Yosef engineered a situation in which Yaakov would be forced to confront that very emotion, where you see that he was favoring Binyamin, because he didn't even send him along with the other brothers. And he didn't think that going to Egypt was such a dangerous thing, but there was enough danger there to warrant his protection of Binyamin. Binyamin, he couldn't subject to that level of danger. The other brothers, he could. So there was a certain favoritism for Binyamin right away. Yosef's objective was to make it impossible, to force him into a situation where he would have to let go, separate himself from Binyamin, otherwise the family couldn't live. That's why he kept Shimon behind. He accused them of spies, and he created this whole ruse in order to bring about a situation in which all of the parties would have to do tshuva. Okay. Now let me, as we go through the story, let's go into certain particulars. For example, let's turn to chapter 42. Chapter 42, and turn to 16, Tes Zion. Okay, actually, if you want, 15, that's when he tells them, that's after he accuses them of being spies. They argue up and back, and he says, no, you're spies. And he says in 16, send one brother. Send one brother and bring your brother back, and you will be locked up, and I will be able to test out your words, whether it's true. And if not, he swears by the life of Paro that you're spies. Then Joseph gathers them in jail for three, puts them all in jail. He locks them up for 3 days. The end of the, then Yosef said to them on the third day, this is what you should do and live. I fear the Lord. If you are honest people, then one brother will be locked up in jail, and the rest of you go and bring the food that you need for your households. And your younger brother, then your younger brother bring to me, and we'll test out your words, and you will not die. And they did that. That's the end of part one over here. What's the problem over here? Questions over here that you could ask. First of all, he changed his plan. His first plan was he locks them all up. Now, he doesn't want to appear like a flighty type of person. He's a serious individual. He certainly wants them to believe that he's a very serious individual. And at first, he locks them up for 3 days. And the plan, well, he doesn't really just lock them all up. And the plan was they should stay behind and one brother. He doesn't want them all going. He only wants one brother to go. And the purpose is to bring back Binyamin, and then I'll release all of you. Then he changes his mind on the third day. It's clearly a change of plan. And on the third day, he says, this is what you should do and live. I fear the Lord. Suddenly he's a God-fearing man. And he underwent some kind of a change in 3 days. He became religious. And then he says, if you're honest people, one brother should stay behind, and the rest of you go. Now he's a very generous kind of guy. All of a sudden, all you go and bring food back and take care of it. No problem. Relax, and bring back your brother, and everything will be okay. I think the question has to be raised. Everything that Yosef did, I mean, of course, if you approach it with my premises, that everything that he did was thought out, was done with a plan. He's not a capricious individual. If I'm reading a history book about a certain person or a ruler, this and that, I'm not going to stop and ask the question because he's just following his emotion. Today he was feeling tough, he acted this way. Tomorrow he felt better. That's something else. I'm dealing with Yosef. Everything was done on the basis of he remembered the dreams. That introduces everything. There's another thing, just agavurcha, so to speak. What is difficult in terms of the words? Now I'm going to show you how each word has to be understood. Take a look at Pasuk Yud Ches 18. Read it and tell me what seems a little bit strange in that Pasuk. Yeah. What do you mean, this is what you should do and live? Well, what do you mean and live? If you don't do it, you're going to die? Wait one second. There was no mention that he intends to kill them for being spies. There's no trial for treason. He accused them of being spies, that is to say that they were coming to spy out the land. But he didn't, at no point did he say that if you refuse, I'm going to kill you. Okay. I would assume that how they were supposed to understand it was that you're spies and I'm not going to let you traverse the land and I'll throw you out of here. I didn't get any sense that there was any intention to kill them. If there was an intention to kill them, then he's not going to let them all go. Then that whole idea would be absurd. He's not going to let them all go if he's really accusing them of an act of treason and have to kill them. That's not the case. So what do you mean this is what you should do and live? What does that have to do? This is what you should do in order to get what you want. So how do you answer the question?
I'm just thinking of the color of the food, aren't they?
Yes.
So are you saying if you don't, you know, if you're not commanded, I'm not going to give you food?
Okay, very good. You see? But that, again, that's not the way you understood it without thinking it through. It means, and live, otherwise you're going to die from famine. That's what he's telling them. This is what you should do in order to survive. The word v'chiyu and live means you have a big problem over here. This famine is not going away so fast. I'm not going to kill you. He wasn't saying I'm going to kill you if you don't do it. That's clearly not the case, because if that's the case, then, you know, Yaakov wouldn't have waited so long to send the brothers back if Shimon, who he kept behind, was in danger of being killed. That was a threat. There's no threat to kill. But he's saying, you're going to die. Because you've got a major problem. You don't have any food. And the famine is not going away so quickly. I can assure you of that. So if you want to live, you need me. And the only way you're going to get me is if you bring back your younger brother. Okay. That's just a question of pshat. That just goes to show that plain pshat. What's the Torah saying? You have to think about it. Briefly, no, the question is a valid question. What kind of test is this? Since they don't know that it's Yosef, so this individual does not know who the brother is. So why couldn't they get any individual, hire a guy, pay a guy to come down, and pretend that he didn't say he's the brother? The answer is that it wouldn't work. Because since he kept Shimon behind, the purpose was he's going to interrogate him about every intimate detail of the family life. Now there's no way, even if they're going to give over the basic family biography, when you're dealing with a person that's as shrewd, as intelligent as Yosef made it clear that he was, there's no way that you can possibly give over everybody every secret of your family. So how do they know, how are they going to know what Shimon is telling Yosef about a dispute that occurred a few years ago in the family and the nuances, the particulars? They can't give this over to a stranger. It's an impossibility. The only way that they could verify it would be by actually having Binyamin, who would know the whole family thing. That's why Yosef was quite confident that they would never do a thing like that. Okay. Now, the question is, what's the reason for the change of plan? That's question number one. My method is, well, I ask a number of questions that are interrelated. I don't want the answer after each question. I'm laying out the terrain. I'm sort of mapping out the objectives. Question number two, something unusual occurs. Well, of course, first of all, you see as a result of this, the brothers immediately realize that something extraordinary is happening to them, and it has to be the will of God. Because in Pasuk Chaf Aleph, they already expressed tshuva, which was part of Yosef's objective. The objective was to get the brothers to recognize that they had done something wrong. And in Chaf Aleph and in Chaf Beis, they say we're guilty concerning our brother. But we saw his suffering when he pleaded with us, and we didn't listen. Therefore, Alkein Bo Eleinu Hatzara Hazos. Therefore has come upon us this day. Regard this, we're all familiar with that. This is a tzara. We still use that word today. This is a calamity. And then Reuben goes further and says, I told you not to sin with the lad. You didn't listen, and now his blood is being demanded of us. Okay. And then, okay, so they realize that something terrible has happened to them. Let's pick it up when they leave. So what happens next? So now they have to go. They have no choice. Shimon is left behind. It says he locks up Shimon to their sight. Then Yosef commands, and they fill up their vessels with food. And interestingly enough, Chafei, what's so interesting over here? What's interesting about Chafei? Money! The money! This is an extremely important element in the story which doesn't get highlighted. The role of the money. The role of the money is extremely important in every phase. And that's when I finally do get there, hopefully soon. What I want to do, what I'm aiming at, is when the brothers return, how that issue of the money is handled. That's a tremendous problem. What to do about that returned money? This becomes, it's sort of lost. It's shuffled to the side because you're concerned with the main issues. Will Yaakov trust them? Will he give up Binyamin? That's the main issue. But lurking behind everything else is the issue of the returned money. And you don't pay attention to that. So I'm sort of focused in on that issue. He gives an order to return their money, each man into his own sack, and to give them food for the road. And they did that. Okay, now the brothers don't know any of this, of course. And the brothers go on their merry way. They're by traveling with on their animals. And take a look at 27. And then Ha'echad opens one of them. Ha'echad means and the one of them. Opens up his sack to provide fodder for his donkey in their camp, in place of camp. And he saw his money, and it was at the opening of his sack. So what happens? What's the reaction to that? Well, normally, you know, if you're in that situation, if you go shopping on a big shopping spree and you spend a lot of money, and then you're in your car and you're unpacking everything and you find all the money there, you're going to be kind of happy. It's unbelievable. You're going to get excited. Well, of course, it's a Shiloh, though. Can I keep it or do I have to bring it back? You may have a moral dilemma. But that moral dilemma will not be so strong that it will prevent the initial reaction of happiness. You'll have a moral dilemma. Not the kind of dilemma that they had. If it was a situation, halakhically, where you could keep the money, then there'd be great joy. However, that's not their reaction. Because he said to his brothers, my money has been returned, and it's in my sack. And their hearts went out, and they trembled. They were, charada is an extreme state of trembling, fear. He put them in a tremendous state of fear, each one to the brother, saying, what is this that God has done to us? So, of course, the question arises, what was his purpose in returning the money? His basic objective, it seems, his basic objective was to create a situation where the brothers would realize that they were being held accountable for their sin. So that was already achieved. Because they had already, but even without the return of the money, the incarceration, the accusation, the need to bring down Binyamin, that itself appeared to them as a tremendous disaster, and they called it a tzara. And they did tshuva, ashamed by now, we're guilty. And as far as the objective with Yaakov is concerned, that seems to have been established. The pressure is there. They're going to need food. They're going to have to come back. In order to do so, he's going to have to part with Binyamin. So, why is he, if anything, the return of the money is going to make it even more difficult. The return of the money is going to make it more difficult in terms of Yaakov. If the return of the money is an element of a fear, a frightening element, something to make them more scared, so why do it? As we are soon going to see, let's take a look. If you put the money, is not over yet, though. Because at this point in time, they only know that only one brother has the money returned. But we know what they do not know, and that's every brother's money has been returned. They didn't check. Did they check? Take a look. Well, you tell me, did they check? Well, let's proceed. Now they return to their father Jacob, land of Canaan, and they told him everything that occurred to them. Listen very carefully. Here's where you must listen very carefully. Pay close attention to their description. And I'm going to ask you to evaluate their capacity to retell an event accurately. Accuracy in reporting. Okay, they said, the man, the master of the land, spoke harshly with us, and he regarded us as though we were spies. And we said to him, we're honest people. We have not been spies. We are 12 brothers, the sons of our father. In other words, we have one common father. The one is not with us. That's a reference to Yosef. He's missing in action. Don't know where he is. And the youngest is today with his father in the land of Canaan. And the man, the master of the land, said to us, with this I will know that you're honest people. One brother you will leave with me, and the food for your house take and go, and you will bring your younger brother to me, and I'll know that you're not spies, that you're honest people. Your brother, that is Shimon, I'll return to you, and the land, you can traverse the land and do business, to Schora is business, free entree into the land, that's it. That is what they told Yaakov. Now you tell me, would you regard that as an accurate account of what had occurred? What they did over here, these are great, great individuals, you know. But for purpose of illustration, I'll cite things that are happening in our society today. This type of thing happens all the time. What's it called? There are two groups of people that engage in this kind of thing. And Lahavla, I'm not comparing them in any way to the brothers who were great men. It's called spinning. They're putting a spin on the situation. There are two groups of people in the society today that have become masters of the spin. One of those two. I hope they're politicians and lawyers. Well, of course, that the celebrities are the ones that need the lawyers to do the innocent. But that's basically what occurred. It's an unfortunate thing. And it's a tragic thing because today it's open. I mean, lawyers are very proud of the fact that we're going to present this label. We're going to present, in other words, we can use this defense as though it's just a game and how we can distort the truth. No one is... isn't that a distortion of the truth? Well, if you're intelligent enough, we can hide this, we can distort that, we can explain it that way. That's sophistry. Okay, I'm not going to go any further right now. Don't get me started on lawyers. I don't want to get... That's a different issue. But on politicians, of course we know, it's spin. You know, everything is a total failure, the whole country's falling apart, and we can show you why it's perfect. It's just exactly the way it's supposed to be. That's a spin. But to a certain extent, now we're dealing with great, great individuals, with tzaddikim. They're all righteous people. Of course, the point of the Torah is that even righteous people can make mistakes, and we learn from those mistakes. But they were not entirely accurate. First of all, they said the man spoke harshly with us. Okay, that is true, but that's putting it mildly. And they said he treated it as though he was spies. What do you mean as though? He accused you of being spies. It wasn't like... They presented it as though the situation is, in order to pass muster, in order to gain entree, they assume you have to prove your innocence for them. You have to establish it. And that's all it is. They completely omitted what? They omitted the fact that they had all been locked up. That's a very important piece of information. They didn't mention anything about the fact they were locked up for 3 days. Nor did they mention anything about the money. That was a very serious thing. They went into a serious stage of fright when they really saw the money. I'd imagine that's not incidental. It certainly had a profound impact upon them. And they don't tell it to Yaakov. You know, you got to tell Yaakov everything. He can't help you unless you tell him everything. They omit that, and also, as Jackie pointed out, they put a positive light on it. And the land will have like permission to trade. First of all, if you take a look at the Mefarshim raised this point, Yosef never said that. Even if you want, that's true. Rashi does not, other Mefarshim take it to mean trade. But no, Aliza's point is well taken, that Rashi, the term also means to travel through the land. Yeah, but even so, what's the point of saying, A, Yosef didn't say that. No matter what, how you translate it, Yosef didn't say that. So it does, the only question is, what does it imply? Even that must be worthwhile. Why would they tell it to their father? So we'll have a right to travel to check out the land. So what? Their point in mentioning it to Yaakov is to get Yaakov to sort of believe that it's somehow different. That it's just more or less a standard kind of a thing. He's a very tough individual. He's very concerned about his country. And these are the conditions. We gave the appearance of being spies. We have to provide verification, and that's what it is. But that certainly, as we know what the Yaakov could not know at that point. And according to this, we have to ask ourselves. I mean, why did they do that? Why didn't they tell the truth to their father? You should be truthful in general, but especially to your father, and especially if your father is someone like Yaakov. But something happens. Yaakov doesn't answer them. Take a look at what happens next. Very strange. Before Yaakov answers them, something happens. In 35, it says, "And then as they were emptying their sacks, and behold, each man's..." What is that called? His wallet. A money clip or something? His money... His money bundle. Each man's... Money bundle? Wallet. Okay. Each man's money pouch was in his sack. And they saw the packets of money, them and their father, and they were afraid. And then Yaakov says to them, "Osti shikaltem, me you've rendered..." Now Yaakov launches a very stinging accusation against them. "You've made me childless." That's the term. Shakula is someone who's bereft of their child. "You've made me childless. Yosef is not here, and Shimon is not here, and you're going to take Binyamin? All this is upon me. Very stinging accusation, and it's even strange because Yaakov is accusing them of Yosef. When Yosef? He didn't, not at one point did he mention Yosef until now. What does that mean? That he's suddenly accusing them of killing Yosef?
Not taking proper care of you.
This whole thing is very strange. It's very strange. Okay, let's pause here. This ends phase one. Let me just state the question. How should you formulate the question? So why did they distort the story? Why didn't they tell Yaakov? They need Yaakov's help. It's a big problem. Yaakov is the wisest of... When it came to the situation of Shechem, when Dinah had been raped and captured by Shechem, they all conferred together. They worked out a plan together. Of course, according to the Ramban, they didn't follow what Yaakov had said. Shimon and Levi decided to act on their own, to go it alone. And Yaakov criticized them. But they conferred together, and they should have learned. They need his wisdom, they need his guidance, they need his intelligence. You got to tell them the truth. So that's Jackie's question. Continue. But the question of the money is still not fully resolved. We don't have all the questions pertaining to the money, the matter of the return money. Yosef obviously planned everything out. He's very shrewd. You can see his brilliance as a planner and how he understood human psychology. That comes through. Whatever his intention was in the return of the money, we see that the discovery of the money happened in two different phases, in two different situations. The money was discovered first by one brother on the road, without the other brothers discovering the money. And the other brothers discovered it later, but not just later, but together with Yaakov. Now, was this engineered by Yosef? Not just the return of the money, but the manner in which the money was to be discovered. That he wanted it to be that way, that one would discover it on the road, and the others would discover it at home, and together with Yaakov. Was that engineered by Yosef? And had so, how could he engineer such a thing? We're not attributing any superhuman powers to him now. Because you could simply say, no, his objective was just to return the money. He knew they'd discover it. But that's the way it worked out. Chance factors, or the Yashkafa, God's providence. Everything over here is happening under God's providence, so you could say it was providence that saw to it that it would happen this way. Or else, I'm saying, and this is what I want to maintain, that this was part of Yosef's design, and he did have a way. He couldn't guarantee, nobody can guarantee absolutely, but I'll show you. Anything can happen. That's why, well, no plan. But I could show you that the question that we have to ask is it conceivable that he had, what gave him the basis, what gave him the basis for assuming that it could work out this way, that it would? Did he have any basis to assume that it possibly could work out this way? Yeah, but specifically, you got to be more specific. Yeah, I know, one thing. If you, excuse me. Jackie is saying, logically, you would assume that it wasn't placed at the opening, because if that's the case, then just like the one who discovered his money as he was feeding his animal, I assume they all have to feed their animals. So in the same way, every other brother would have discovered his money. Why would it be just the one? So therefore, Jackie says, you must assume that in the case of the others, it wasn't at the opening. It must have been all the way at the bottom somewhere. You'd think so, wouldn't you? Because otherwise all the other brothers would have discovered or at least some of them would have discovered it. Why would it be the one? That's unusual. So you would therefore say that, isn't it strange if you take a look at the pasuk? Please take a look at Mem Gimel, that's 43. Chapter 43 and verse 12. This is Yaakov when he's finally decided to let them go, and he's giving them instructions. And what does he say? Alright, first he says, bring a gift back to the man. That's one thing. Now in Pasuk Yudbeis he says, and take twice the money. Kesef Mishnah. Take twice the money. Take in your hands, and the money that's been returned, b'fi amtuchoseichem. At the opening of your sacks, of your carrying sacks, whatever you want, whatever I'm called, right? Toshivu b'yetchem, return it in your hand. Ulai mishku, maybe it's a mistake. Now, I think it's pretty clear that he's referring to all of the monies that were returned b'fi Am techoseichem. Now, if it was just at the opening of one of the sacks, this pasuk doesn't make any sense. It is clear from this pasuk that the money was at the opening of all of the sacks. Parenthetically, KB, that's Agavurcha. Parenthetically, KB is asking, why did they just say that he's missing? Why did they say that he was dead? Well, first of all, he wasn't dead. He'd been sold. He'd been sold. Why didn't they say that he was dead or anything like that? You're talking about Yosef now, right?
Yes. They just had the coat.
Practically speaking, it would not have made any sense to say anything. Yeah, anything that might implicate them. He was sold. This, something happened, foul play, so Yosef would have used it against them.
Because
then they're telling Yaakov, this is what we answered intelligently, this is what we said. We weren't foolish. They want to convince Yaakov that they handled the situation perfectly and everything they said made sense. But first of all, they couldn't tell Yaakov the truth that Yosef was sold. They couldn't tell him that anyway. They weren't ready to fess up at this point. They couldn't have told him that. You see? And certainly they didn't want to tell Yosef anything. Yeah, now you're going to have to explain, well, one second, your brother was sold? Who sold him? How did that happen? You just keep it, you know, the less you tell in a situation, the less, don't give away unnecessary information, okay? You have to know who you're talking to. The first issue is like this. The first issue is that Yosef changed his plan. Clearly, at first he's much harsher with them. He's extremely harsh, and he locks them all up, and he tells them they'll have to send one brother home. Now, clearly Yosef never intended to go through with that. That was part of the plan. He knew that would never work. He knew Yaakov. He knew if one brother returned home and the rest of them were locked up, that there's no way that Yaakov would ever send Binyamin. It was plan. The plan that he ended up with was the plan all along. But in order for Yosef's plan to be successful, to bring about the necessary tshuva, he had to balance the forces. And this he did with tremendous brilliance. He had to create an impression in their mind that they were facing something which could be of calamitous proportions. A tzara. Now, when you're doing that, you've got to act very harshly. You've got to show people that this is really, really serious. So therefore, he locked them all up. He came on extremely strong, extremely powerful. He locked them up. This is extremely serious. Then, however, there's a problem. If he is going to be too tyrannical, if he's going to be too arbitrary, then his whole plan is going to fall apart. Because if they got the impression that we're dealing with a situation which we're just headed into destruction, so of course they're not going to send Binyamin. He had to leave them at least a certain amount of room for an alternative explanation that he's a tough individual, but he can reason with this guy. He's a reasonable person. He's tough. If there's no toughness in the situation, if it's too easy, so then he's not going to achieve his objective with the brothers or even with Yaakov. So then of course Yaakov would let Binyamin go. But letting Binyamin go in that situation would not constitute a threat to Yaakov. Would not force Yaakov to overcome the emotion. If the situation was secure and safe and so forth, so then of course Yaakov would be willing to take a chance with Binyamin, but that wouldn't achieve the objective of forcing him to overcome the attachment to Binyamin. That demanded that Yaakov understand that he's embarking on a course he has no choice, but it does contain the possibility of great danger. So Yosef had to establish the possibility of great danger. So therefore you have to act extremely harshly. But once you're doing that, then you have another problem. If you're too harsh and too arbitrary, you're dealing with someone who is an impossible dictator. You can't get Saddam Hussein. You're not going to send anybody back because the man's a nut. You can't. Therefore, Yosef had to come across and show, I'm a tough individual. I'm very, very tough. I'm protecting my country. If anybody tries to harm this country, he'll suffer. But Elokim ani yari. Then he came back after 3 days and said, I'm a very reasonable guy. Because I've been thinking it over. I can compromise. I don't have to lock all you guys up. Meanwhile, you got families at home. Maybe what you're saying is true. You got families at home. They're all starving. They don't have any food. I'll tell you what, I worked out a deal that satisfies both our interests. Your interests are, you need food, and you claim your honor. My interests are, I gotta protect my country. So to protect my country, I don't need all you guys here. All I need is one. So therefore, I'm gonna release you all. take food all you need, go back home, and I'll keep one brother behind. That's all I need. I'll interrogate him. And then you'll come back, and I'll speak to that brother, and everything will be straightened out. I'll give you. He had to do that. Because if he hadn't done that, then there's no way the plan goes forward. Now, Elohim, I fear the Lord. I'm showing you a whole new dimension about my personality that you didn't know. You thought I'm this tough, ruthless. I'm not a tough, ruthless individual. I'm a good guy, but good guys have to be ruthless too. As we know. So, that explains why he went through the change. That is very important, by the way, in understanding the whole story over here. It revolves around maintaining, Yosef has to maintain a balance of tension. And it could never change. He could not be, that element of possible calamity, of danger, must be there. But at the same time, the possibility that this individual, that we're all together wrong, I'm going to show you how that comes out at the end. He leaves open enough room that maybe we're making a big mistake, and this guy, after all, is going to be okay. That suspense will always be there, and you'll see it in the final phase, which is the ultimate objective of what this is all about. But Yaakov didn't send Binyamin originally. That's because simply he was very attached to him, and there's no need to expose him to any excessive danger. But if they came back, and there was no real problem, I'll show you that. You'll see when they came back, they spoke to Yaakov in a certain way. That's why they spoke to him that way, to diminish the danger. If Yaakov had to send Binyamin, and he was convinced that there's no real danger, then he would have sent him. You see?
Why did he convince him?
The brothers didn't care. So they understood that Binyamin was now the favorite, and that he was there. They didn't want to hurt Yaakov anymore. They had no qualms. They had no qualms with Binyamin. They had no problem with Binyamin. Okay? On this basis, we can understand the return of the money. The return of the money is an integral component of the plan. And I want to maintain... Take a look. There's a change. In the first instance, by virtue of the misunderstanding that they were being accused of spies and they had to leave one brother behind, they regard that as a tzara, as a misfortune. And it was sufficient to engender thoughts of repentance, of tshuva. But the language changes after they find the money. Now they say, because what do you mean? What are they saying? What is this that God has done to us? What do you mean? That you had this problem? They already recognized they were in a situation of a problem. This is a whole new ballgame. This is a whole new situation. At first, they were in a situation which could be understood as a misunderstanding. Because we acted in such a way which could give the impression of spies. This individual, look at his perspective. He has to be extremely careful to protect his country. So it's a misfortune that it should happen to us, that we should fall into the situation. But it's something which can be rectified. In order to rectify it, it's going to cause a tremendous problem. But that's one type of a misfortune. These things happen sometimes. You can get into a problem. You could be driving cross country and you forgot to take along your license and your registration. So you get pulled over for some reason. And then the whole thing can snowball. You don't have driver's license, you don't have a registration. And meanwhile, a crime took place 3 weeks ago and they think it's you. And you get locked up. And you know that eventually it's going to be straightened out. You call up home, they'll fax you the alliance. But meanwhile, it's a big pain. But it's a pain and a misfortune, but it's one that you can deal with. It's not going to destroy you. That's the way they looked at it. That such a misfortune should befall them, they realized has to be because of God, the Ashkacha. So then they began to do tshuva. But that wasn't sufficient. That, somebody mentioned it before, that was an incomplete tshuva. That was the beginning of tshuva. They were beginning to recognize this. That was the recognition. Let me explain to you. Tshuva has three components. The first component is recognition of your sin. Until this point, they never even admitted that they sinned. The second point in tshuva is regret and shame that we could do such a thing. And the third point is an absolute change for the future. If you don't have that third point, it's Kabbalah ala Asid, that you accept upon yourself to change for the future, then it's not complete. So this was insufficient. It was the beginning of tshuva, but it wasn't complete. In order to bring about the complete tshuva, it had to be a greater... This is a worse calamity. The return of the money, what did this... Why were they so afraid the money was returned?
It's
And what is God doing to us? What do you mean? Something matter with the time? Of course, what is it?
One is an objective kind of thing. It has to end with this is personal.
This appears to be part of a plot. If it's up until now, they were falling back on the idea that this is a misunderstanding. We'll clear it up. But now it could be worse. This could be a plot, which means to say that it could very well be that he's looking for a scapegoat. He's targeting us because he wants to. Egypt is being infiltrated by all kinds of people. Now he wants to make a showcase trial to demonstrate for the entire world what's going to happen if you try and spy. So he was just looking for a victim to make it look feasible. If that is the case, if his objective is to find a victim, a scapegoat, then we're finished. I mean, then this is a ruse. Bringing back Binyamin is not going to help. We're just walking into destruction. That's why they were afraid. They said, "What is this that God has done to us?" It's one thing to have a misunderstanding, but to have fallen into a plot to destroy us, that's a different type of a calamity. Operating on the concept of measure for measure. They, roughly speaking, God punishes measure for measure. Now, again, I'm not going into when you know that it's from God or when it's just something which happened, so to speak, because of the laws of nature. But they understood that they were under the ashkach, under the problem. So it's measure for measure. I mean, if it's a milder blow, so then the sin is milder. If it's a more significant blow, I'm going to keep looking. That's, obviously, I didn't elucidate it. Now, that was the reason for the return. The return of the money was necessitated by his objective of bringing about tshuva, A, for the brothers, to make it clear to the brothers that the situation is possibly more dangerous than they thought it was. It's very necessary for them. And that's why, in my opinion, he arranged it that one of the brothers could maneuver such a thing. I refer you to the Ramban. I'll just describe how it was done. Yosef had complete control over the loading, how everything would be loaded, and so forth. He had his men. That's why the Pasuk mentions that he told his men to fill up the sacks. The brothers weren't there. Yosef had complete control over the situation. Now, as the Ramban points out, each person had the different amounts. And different, it wasn't just one sack. They had many, many sacks, many, many bundles. They were loading up the animals. So they all had to be loaded in a certain way to balance them out. So therefore, Yosef was able to control the situation. If he wanted to, he knew which one the brothers would go to get immediate, the one that was closest at hand. So there must have been one bundle that they would all go to on the road. It says, Tzei Daladerach. He prepared the Tzei. He prepared. Tzei Daladerach means the stuff you're going to need on the road. He prepared that for them. So Yosef had control over all these things. Now, this is my speculation. I'm speculating on this. You can disagree with me. You can have an alternative. I have no problem with that. This is the way I'm positing this. It wasn't by accident that the one founded it, Noah Echad. This was designed. In this case, for this brother, it was at the opening. So that as soon as he opened it, it would fall out. Or he would see it. However, with regard to the others, he had it in the sack, which they would not open on the way. So then that was clearly within his power. That was clearly within his power to control that situation. We have to know why. Now the brothers, when they saw that, became frightened. It didn't occur to them that this would be the case with all their sacks, because when they opened their sacks, they didn't see the money. The idea of unpacking everything on the road and searching through, that didn't make any sense. What's the point of that? They didn't think so in the first place, and what good is it going to do anyways? So why should they bother to unpack and repack? That didn't make any sense. But it's clear that they had no thought. It's clear that the brothers had no thought. They did not suspect that their monies were returned. What's the proof of that? What? But also they would not, exactly, they wouldn't, if they suspected that, they wouldn't have unpacked them for Yaakov. That becomes the next point. I'll explain that to you. You'll see it'll all become bag which had the money, it was at the opening. That's why Yaakov says, the monies that were returned at the opening of your sack. In that sack which had the money, it was at the opening. But that sack which had the money was not placed in the same position on every donkey. That's what I'm saying. Only one. That's what I'm positing. Now, The question then arises, automatically the question arises, with regard to the discovery, why did he work it out in such a way that the remaining brothers would discover the money later on, and together with Yaakov. Now, I think the answer is very clear. The return of the money was necessary to frighten the brothers, but it was also necessary to frighten Yaakov. That was the more significant of the two determinants. That Yaakov had to be placed in a situation where there was no way he could minimize the dangers, where he'd have a tremendous conflict. On the one hand, he had to send Binyamin. On the other hand, he had to recognize that he was possibly never going to see him again. As we see, when he leaves him, what does he say? Bani kasher shacholti shacholti. I'm prepared to accept the fact. I may lose Binyamin. I may lose my child, but I have to have no choice. Then and only then does he confront the emotion. Now, Yosef knew the brothers. Why did the brothers distort the situation? When the brothers came back to Yaakov, they already had a very clear picture of the situation, that it's a very serious, very dangerous situation. And they knew about Yaakov's emotional attachment to Binyamin. If they would have told the truth, then there's no way that he would have left Binyamin. Now, they didn't know. They didn't have these dreams. They didn't have the rights that Yosef had to impose this obligation. And so they were acting compassionately. They had to make the decision. The decision is we're gonna die. We're going to need food. And we have to get Binyamin. If we tell Yaakov the truth, his emotional attachment is going to block the whole thing. We have no choice. We have to present. We have to explain Binyamin, but we have to present it in a way that he can accept. So he'll go along with it. If they were to, Yosef, of course, knew that they would do that. Yosef knew that these brothers are shrewd people. They're very intelligent. They got rid of him, and they still retained their relationship with the father. They were able to finesse that one. They got away with it. They got away with it. So, if that's the case, Yosef knew very well that when they go back and they confront Yaakov, they'll put a spin on the situation. You could always explain it in one way or another, and that would defeat his whole purpose. So then Yaakov would let Binyamin go, but he would never have to do tshuva. So Yosef took precautions against that. Yosef took precautions. What the brothers came back and acted exactly as he thought they would. You see the explanation, the spin. Not so terrible, not so bad. And interestingly enough, when did Yaakov answer them? Oshishi called them. Not when they finished their explanation. It doesn't say a word. At that point, Yaakov doesn't say a word. Then they begin to unpack. Then they see the money. Then Yaakov says, positing that if there was no money, if they would have unpacked and they wouldn't have discovered the money, then Yaakov wouldn't have had that reaction. Now, how did Yosef control the situation? How did he control the situation? Just from a practical point of view. Because you might ask, how did Yosef know that the Yaakov would be there when they'd be unpacking? I mean, wouldn't you think that they've been on a long journey, they'd come home first, they'd wash up, they'd have a bite, then they'd go to the father and talk.
They were worried that they didn't get points straight.
I would say this, not because the brothers were worried. No. Listen, let me explain. Right, take a look at Membe's Chav Tes, 42-29. They came to their father Yaakov in the land of Canaan. And they told him everything that had happened to them. I'm saying that it wasn't just that they came and they told, but there was a question they were answering. The Torah does not record it, but everything they said over there was in response to a question, which is not being recorded. What's that question?
Where's Shimon?
They knew very well that Yaakov would be waiting for them at the gate, so to speak, waiting for their return. Because he was concerned about them. You see, he kept the young behind. He realized there was an element of danger. He had no choice. He regarded them as being older, as capable, but he loved them, he was concerned about them, so they knew that he'd be waiting for them. And as soon as he came back, as soon as they came back, what's the first thing that even would happen? Where's Shimon? Where's Shimon? No one's going to do anything. No unpacking, no eating, no nothing. Where is Shimon? That's the question. That's when they get that whole answer. Take a look at their whole answer. The whole answer is basically an explanation of why Shimon is not here and what's the... It's not such a big deal. Don't worry about it. Everything's okay. They didn't even mention that Shimon was locked up. Isn't it true that Shimon was in jail? Did they say anywhere that he's in jail? Where does it say that he's in jail? It says, Achichem ha'echad hanichu iti, leave him with me. It wasn't with him, he was in jail. It's quite a different story. Right? And that's not the way it was. One second, let me finish. Yosef, in my opinion, anticipated this. That Yaakov would be there. And that the brothers would have to give the explanation. And if they would have succeeded, if there would have been no further development, then it's quite likely that Yaakov would have accepted the story. Because why should he assume they were lying? So then Yaakov is right there, and then they begin to unpack. And it makes sense that Yaakov would be there for the unpacking, because there's a lot of provisions, they need his advice in terms of how to distribute the food, how to preserve the food. Yaakov was there to watch the unpacking. Or perhaps he was just watching the situation. Then when he saw them unpacking, and they it says, Hema ve'avi, and they saw the money, vayiro, and they were afraid, then Yaakov said, forget it. Yosef knew that they would try to smooth their way out of the situation. The purpose of the money was to undermine the brothers. All of a sudden Yaakov realizes it's not what you're saying it is. Oh, Sishi Kaltam, there's something wrong here. There's something rotten over here. Foul play. He even mentions Yosef. He's not accusing them. All he's saying is, there's something wrong. I don't trust you, fellas. His answer basically is, I can't trust you. That's the whole... OCC Kalten means you are careless, you're reckless, there's problems over here. I'm not aware of, I don't know what the problems are. But all I know is I sent out Yosef just on a simple trip to find out what was doing. He never came back. Now I sent you all out. Shimon didn't come back. And Binyamin Tikahu? Now you're telling me you guys got yourself into some kind of fix. You got yourself into some kind of problem. And I should send Allah Yafalana. You don't care about me. You're insensitive to my needs, to my problems. Allah, what am I still? How much can I take in my life? I can't trust you. That's his first reaction. And that was engineered brilliantly, in my opinion, by Yosef. Of course he had to have the help of the Ashkacha. A million things could have happened to thwart it. Because nobody can control. It could be that Yaakov could have not been feeling well that day and not been there. Anything could happen. But Yosef did the most appropriate plan. The Ashkacha then went along and saw it through. That's the end of phase one. The reaction of Yaakov takes place after he sees the money.
He didn't have to say anything. The money was essential. But
that's
I'm it. Saying that.
Getting back to that question, the side question, that if we say that Yaakov redirected his emotions of love from Yosef to Binyamin, and he now Binyamin became the favorite, so why you would expect that, and the brothers had not yet done tshuva, so why didn't the brothers hate Binyamin as they hated Yosef? Yet it doesn't seem to be the case. They did not have this hatred.
He didn't have dreams, which he shared with them.
There's no doubt. See, first of all, you're right. It wasn't simply, it's true that the fact that he was favored by Yaakov was a factor, but also the fact that they had a tough time accepting his vanity or his egotism, and in the dreams that he would be the ruler over them, that's a key factor. And so he's a threat. Binyamin didn't pose a threat to them. So since Binyamin didn't pose a threat to them, then it wouldn't have the same effect. It's only when there's a competitive factor going on. If there's no competitive factor going on, it's not the same thing. You know, you're not going to have that same envy. That's one reason. What else was? I also think it's true that that's a displaced kind of love. They realized that the envy of Yosef is because they all want to be in that position. In other words, They want the love of Yaakov. Why do they want the love of Yaakov? Because Yaakov is this, they look up to Yaakov. He's this great man. He's on such a high plane. So therefore, if he loves me, if I'm the favorite, that means he recognizes my qualities. But they realize, so they're envious of Yosef, because Yosef has what they want. But Binyamin got the love not because of that reason. He didn't love Binyamin because of who Binyamin was. He loved Binyamin because that was a displaced kind of a love. So it wouldn't elicit that kind of an envy. See, that's a good point. Think about that for a moment. The envy is not just because you're getting love, I'm not getting love. There's something more behind it. That love has a significance. That's what you want. What you're looking for is that kind of an approval. You want that approval, especially from a man like Yaakov. So the fact that he's getting it and I'm not means that he's worthy of the approval and I'm not worthy, and I can't take the fact that I'm not worthy, so I hate him. That's how it works. So that, for that very reason, if the love is a displaced love, means it's not essential to Binyamin as Binyamin. It doesn't reflect a recognition of Binyamin's qualities. It's just an accident of the fact that Binyamin represents Yosef. So therefore, it's not going to cause any animosity towards Binyamin. There's no envy of Binyamin. So that's why you could have this situation. That, true, he found a substitute, but that does not elicit, it's an interesting point in psychology, does not elicit the same type of a rivalry and hatred as the original.